who mourned himself. Yeah, country loved.
Good afternoon, good afternoon. This is the Talk of Chicago, 1690 WVON. I'm Cliff Kelly. It's Saturday, March 7th. Gorgeous day out. America's Heroes Group Roundtable. We are globally connected with Kaiser Health News. We are proudly sponsored by Pearl's Place Down Home Southern Cooking. Believe me, a buffet, if you want that, is just great. 3901 South Michigan Avenue, right here in Chicago, Illinois. The phone number is 877-275-5852. Also, America's Heroes Group is proudly sponsored by the Tuskegee Airmen, Inc., Chicago Dodo Chapter. Ken Rapier is the president. They are at 8035 South Walcott Avenue, Chicago, Illinois, 60620. And the phone number there is 773-879-2698. They do such great work. America's Heroes Group, She Serves, She Matters, partner and sponsor of National Women's Veterans United, NWVU. National Women's Veterans United is at 8620 South Pulaski Road, looked at the lower level, Chicago, Illinois, 60652. The office number is 872-731-2150. Website, www.nwvu.org. And it's just great that all of these great people are sponsoring us. And America's Heroes Group Roundtable, we are globally connected with Kaiser Health News. All of you know March is National Women's Month. You know that. I am the host, Cliff Kelly. Our executive producer is Glenda Smith. Our digital media producer is Manny Corazzari. And we are going to be talking in just a moment about high deductibles affecting rural patients and hospitals. And this is very important. And on our live line, we have Marki-Ann Hulaluk, who is the senior Colorado correspondent for KHN based in Denver. He has reported on health care for more than 25 years, writing for such publications as the Houston Chronicle, the American Medical News, and most recently, Ben Oregon. That's the bulletin. And he's on our live line, and we're just so pleased to have him. How are you today, sir?
I'm fine, Cliff. How are you?
Good, 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 good. Thank you so much for being with us.
I appreciate you having me on your show.
Absolutely. There's so much going on here that you would know about, that our listeners need to know about. Start off. Help us understand what is going on here.
Sure. What we've seen happen in healthcare over the last, maybe 10 to 15 years is sort of a steady rise in the annual deductible that's included in health insurance. And so the way the deductible works, I'm sure a lot of your listeners probably already know, it's an amount of money that you will have to pay out of pocket before your insurance kicks in. So, if your deductible is $1,000 on your plan, and you go to the hospital and you get a bill of, $1,500, you'd be responsible for that first $1,000, your deductible, and then the hospital, then the insurance would kick in and pay the remaining $500 of your bill. But what we've seen is that deductible creep up to, you know, $2,000, $3,000, $5,000, sometimes even $10,000 in recent years. And you can imagine, I mean, that's a hefty expense for somebody who has insurance to incur after using their healthcare plan.
Sure.
And this is a part of this is it happened with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, because after that you had a lot of people buying insurance on what we call the individual market. So these are people who don't get insurance through their employer or aren't covered by a government program like Medicaid or Medicare, and they've got to shop for their health insurance on these so-called healthcare exchanges every November. And what the insurance companies have figured out is that most people shop for their insurance based on the premium. So what is this going to cost me every month to have this insurance? And a $300 plan looks cheaper than a $400 plan every month. And the way that insurance companies keep those premiums low is to shift some of their expected costs to things like the deductible or your copay every time you go to the doctor, or you pay $15 or something of that sort. So they shift some of that financial risk and some of that burden onto the insured patient. So we have seen these really high deductibles come into play. And for sure, this happens all over the country in, urban and rural areas. But what we found in rural areas was that it was hitting patients and hospitals particularly hard. Mm. I'm sure, Cliff, you've probably heard that throughout the country, there have been a lot of rural hospitals that have closed.
Yes.
They just can't make enough money off of the limited population that they have, that they serve, to keep their doors open. And the high deductible plans have sort of added an additional burden onto these rural hospitals. And the scenario that I'd heard from rural hospitals here in Colorado was, in some of these rural areas, you have these really small hospitals that their job is basically, if somebody gets into an auto accident or has a stroke or a heart attack, they don't really have the same kind of specialists you might find in the big city to treat these patients in this rural hospital. So their job is really to sort of stabilize that patient and then to transfer them when they can be safely transferred to a larger hospital that can do all the high-tech, the really in-depth kind of healthcare that those patients need. But what ends up happening is when the bills come in, that rural hospital submits its bill, and that bill ends up getting applied towards the deductible. And oftentimes that patient can't pay a $10,000 deductible.
Sure.
So the rural hospital doesn't get paid. The urban hospital, on the other hand, by the time they submit their bills, that patient's deductible has already been met, and the insurance company starts paying the urban hospital first dollar coverage. They get all their bills covered. So the big kind of affluent area, rich hospitals are continuing to pull in money, and these small, poor rural hospitals are trying to figure out how to keep their lights on.
I'm so pleased. This is an unfortunate situation, obviously, but a lot of people don't know about it, and I'm just so pleased that you're putting it out there so that folks do understand. Our number, for those who might have a question for our guest, is 312-374-8130, 312-374-8130. This is something that is particularly difficult for a lot of people, as our guest is saying, who is an expert on this issue. What else could be done, American, to help try to do something about this?
Yeah, there's been a lot of debate about how we could actually help bring down those deductibles or help those rural hospitals and those rural patients. And one of the main ways that governments are trying to get at this problem is through competition. And in a lot of rural areas, there's only one health plan. available to these patients. You know, they go on these exchanges, the healthcare exchanges, to purchase their plan, and they, you know, they're supposed to. The idea was under the Affordable Care Act, it'd be like buying an airplane ticket, and you would log on and see what your options are. Do I want to fly United or American? Do I want to pay for a first class ticket or a fly in coach? Do I want to have a lot of connections or do I want a direct flight? And you make your decisions based on what you can afford and what's important to you. Mm-hmm. Well, it didn't work out that way with health plans because, mm-hmm. In a lot of these rural counties, people logged on and there was only one plan offered in their county. So it was sort of a take it or leave it kind of thing. And often these plans had high deductibles. So a lot of effort has been made now to try and increase competition and get more insurance companies to enter those markets so that you now have a choice of two or three plans. That's happening here in Colorado, and one of the ways Colorado is getting more competition in is through a sort of a public option type of plan. This is a plan that's sort of organized by the state government, and they are negotiating the rates. They are setting the rates that they will pay hospitals, and they are asking insurance companies, hey, take these rates and offer a plan in this little rural county so these people have a choice of a different plan. There's also been other proposals as to how we might be able to lower deductibles. Some of the hospital groups have proposed something called simplified billing, where the hospital would sort of get paid first from the insurance company, and then if there was any deductible to be collected or any co-pays or something of that sort, the insurance company would just get that directly from the patient. That would help rural hospitals avoid the situation where they've got a patient who they've treated, but that patient hasn't been able to pay their deductible, and so they're not getting paid at all. It might not be something insurance companies are all that excited about because now they become the bill collector versus the hospital. Some of the hospital associations, on the other hand, have been promoting sort of different scenarios where a lot of the kind of primary care that makes up the bread and butter of their services wouldn't be applied deductible at all. That this would be free, just like your flu shot is free now, or mm-hmm. some of the other preventive services that you don't have to pay for out of pocket. None of those have really gotten a lot of traction other than maybe the public option here in Colorado.
And so at least there is, of course, I think you probably get a lot of credit for this because you are the one putting out all of the information about what's going on here, Mark Ann. But there is some progress being made. Is that correct?
Yes, I think so. I think there's at least a recognition that this is a problem.
Okay.
And that's, I think, the first step towards towards trying to address it. As I said earlier, you know, we've seen a lot of rural hospital close.
When those
rural hospitals close, patients, where are they supposed to go for care?
Exactly.
Some patients have to drive an hour to get to the nearest hospital now. So we're looking at different kinds of models. Could there be a freestanding emergency room, for example, that doesn't have the costs of a full hospital with it, but is there to provide that emergency care when somebody needs it and can't take that time to travel? And I think we'll see, when the next elections come around, whatever the makeup is of Congress, I think these are some of the issues that are at the top of their agenda. What will we do with the Affordable Care Act? Will we continue to build on it, or we try to take a different direction?
I think you're right on that. I think you're totally correct. There'll be some people talking about that. Let me ask, this is a show, as you know, that is primarily all just families and everybody else, but also the military. What's the VA doing there?
Yeah, and the VA, obviously there's a lot of veterans that live in rural areas.
Sure.
So this is a huge issue for veterans. And, you know, the VA obviously has its healthcare system. It's got clinics and it's got its own hospitals. But oftentimes those are far away from where veterans live. And so veterans, one, may have the opportunity to visit a local provider and have the VA pick up the tab for that. But of course, you know, if a veteran is in an accident or has some sort of emergency situation, they're going to take them to the closest hospital, regardless mm-hmm. of, you know, whether it's a VA hospital or a public or private hospital. Mm-hmm. So they could wind up in a similar situation. And I'll confess, although my dad was a veteran himself and a career military guy,
wow.
I'm not as up to speed on veteran healthcare as I would have liked to be, but I know it's an issue.
Shape up. he was a career what service?
Yeah, he was a doctor in the U.S. Army.
Oh, a doctor yet? Oh,
yeah,
wow. Okay.
Served in Vietnam for 2 years
wow.
when I was just a wee lad, mm. and ended up working at Walter Reed Hospital and the Pentagon and more around the D.C. area. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us, but he gave me a good start in both both healthcare and in life.
I was going to say that. Yeah, he may not be with us, but the things he has done are still with us. That's for sure, and that's obvious.
Absolutely,
that's obvious with what you're doing. Yeah, your dad really served. When we talk about it, he was a physician in Nam in a career. So, do you know any how things are going there with the VA at all?
You know, the VA's obviously had its challenges. I'm sure
yeah.
your listeners know this well, that,
right.
You know, we've had some horribly long waiting lists and the VA hadn't mm-hmm. been particularly honest about the length of those lists.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a big push, to reform, the VA across the country and
right.
you know, particularly in some of the western states, mm-hmm. there's just a lot of veterans living out here, you know, and
mm-hmm.
so, obviously we know that, the vets have some special needs. And the VA system tries to address those needs as best they can, but you know, I hear from a lot of vets over the years, you know, that they'd like the system to work a lot better.
I don't doubt that, and I'm sure that what you do helps a lot of people understand the fact that there needs to be some more things done, and particularly when you say the VA has had a long waiting list. I believe you said had. Is that past tense? Is that past?
You know, I think those lists are never as short as vets
as
would like
they should
them to be, right?
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
that, and I think we owe that to our vets. You know, they served proudly. We should be able to get them prompt and high quality health care. And so I think there has been some movement on that. But as I said, my understanding is it's not necessarily where we would like that system to be.
I'm sure that it is shorter than it would be if it were not for you.
I would like to take credit for that, Cliff, but I can't say I've done a lot of reporting on that issue. Although a lot of my colleagues, a lot of the really good health journalists in this country have tried to shine a light on that problem and try to get some movement on that issue.
Well, we reach a whole lot of people, Mark Ann. You know, we can find out online how many people we reach in other parts of the country and so forth. And we get a whole lot of folks that we really are surprised that we get. We're very happy to. And I'm sure that a lot of folks that hear us do so because of what you do. And I just think it's great because there's a lot of people out there that really need the health and the help that you talk about. And I just want to thank you not only for doing that, for continuing to do it, and particularly to talk about your dad. Wow, doctor in the U.S. Army in Vietnam. That's saying a lot. We just appreciate what you're doing. Give us a closing statement, if you will.
Well, you know, Cliff, maybe I can just tell a quick story about one woman that I encountered that ran into this issue. Her name was Christy Flowers, and ironically, she was actually a registered nurse. And she was about 52, and she'd been sick with the flu for 4 or 5 days. She just wasn't getting any better, so she finally, you know, went to her local community hospital. They diagnosed her with pneumonia and sepsis. Her right lung was just completely filled with fluid, and it was just much more care than that hospital could provide. So they stabilized her. They transferred her by ambulance about 80 miles to a hospital in Colorado Springs. She got put on a ventilator for 10 days, and they slowly nursed her back to health. After about 2 weeks, they sent her back to her community hospital for another week of rehab, and she turned out okay.
That's great.
The bills are what was interesting. She ended up getting $8,000 in medical bills.
Wow.
And a big chunk of that was due to the small community hospital that first treated her. She ended up having to take out a loan to fill that to pay off that medical tab. And that's the kind of issue we're talking about. Those are they're just huge numbers that people are struggling with, and we got to kind of figure out a system to help people and help those rural hospitals.
Keep up the great work. Certainly appreciate
it. Thank you,
Cliff. All right.
Hey,
thank you so
too.
Much.
Appreciate
right.
it. Have a great day.
Stay with us. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Cliff Kelly, Vietnam veteran and host of America's Heroes Group, the game changer in radio, print, and digital media programming. We are a roundtable talk show where information, resources, and referrals are provided intentionally every Saturday to empower our military population on WVON 1690 AM, the iHeart Radio app from 4 to 6 p.m. Central Standard Time. Please visit our website at www.americashg.org.
Hey Cliff, where can a veteran business owner go on the south side of Chicago for breakfast, lunch, and dinner meetings?
I'm a veteran, and that's an easy answer. Pearl's Place on 39th and Michigan. Pearl's Place has free parking available across the street. Reasonably priced, quality food that tastes delicious. Veteran owners, there's no place like Pearl's Place.
Hi, we're the National Women Veterans United, the proud sponsors and partners of the American Hero Group.
Our mission is to ensure that women veterans are aware and have access to their VA benefits, resources, and entitlement. We monitor current or pending legislation that may impact VA eligibility and services. And we provide a safe place for women to come relax. We have a meditation room. They can get food, clothing, housewares, whatever emergency services they may need.
We're the only Women Veterans Center in the state of Illinois. We are members of the Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, Coast Guard, National Guard, and the Reserves.
Hi, I'm Cliff Kelly, Vietnam veteran and host of America's Heroes Group radio talk show. It's an honor to salute the bravery, sacrifice, and legacy of the Tuskegee Airmen, shoulders of excellence and resilience that helped to pave the way for all African American soldiers, men and women, past and present, to serve.
Hi, I'm Sister Soldier, proud partner of She Voices on America's Heroes Group. She serves, she matters, where your change becomes empowered. Also, watch me on the web at SheVetInspires.com or YouTube. Remember, I'm every woman because I am just like you.
Hi, I'm Cliff Kelly, Vietnam veteran and host of America's Heroes Group radio talk show. Gerard Moore, you are a millennial, and I appreciate your support and appreciation for our veteran population.
Yes, Cliff, it's an honor for me to show my support and my appreciation always, especially during Black History Month. Thank you, veterans.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, good afternoon. This is the Talk of Chicago, 1690 WVON. I'm Cliff Kelly. It is Saturday, March 7th, and March is National Women's History Month. America's Heroes Group Roundtable Public Policy is what we are doing now, and we've got our panelists here, and we are so pleased to have them of these topics that we have today. Our panelists, Colonel Dr. Damon Arnold.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Cliff.
How are you, sir?
Okay.
Good, good, good. And, of course, we all know the wonderful Rochelle Crump when you start talking about women. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Good. President accounted for, sir.
Good, 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 good. Sean Claiborne is with us. We're going to talk about money and some other things. He's always there. And thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Good. And I want to mention that Attorney Ernesto Borges was supposed to be with us, and he let us know, and I always ask about his wife. She has some health challenges, so she can't be here. So we'll be certainly hoping that she's going to be all right. We want to talk about a number of things. We're going to start off with a CNN audio following up veterans' reaction to a Trump downplaying traumatic brain injury. Listen up.
The military is now looking at strengthening these protective bunkers at the Al Asad Air Base in Iraq, where more than 100 U.S. troops suffered traumatic brain injuries after an Iranian ballistic missile attack. Bunker improvements to provide better protection against those injuries that President Trump has continuously dismissed.
I can report it is not very serious. Not very serious. I heard that they had headaches.
But his own defense secretary, Mark Esper, acknowledging it is something more.
And this was a new challenge to us. It's the first time we've seen our service members subject to a ballistic missile attack with a 1,000-pound-plus warhead.
More than 400,000 U.S. troops have been diagnosed with traumatic brain injury, or TBI, in the last two decades. Now, the Pentagon is searching for crucial new answers on rapid diagnosis, treatment, and protection from the blast pressure of weapons explosions. For some military families and veterans, the president's continued downplaying of TBI brought fresh grief and a renewed push to bring attention to the seriousness of these injuries. Ryan Bridge survived several blasts in Afghanistan. He still wakes up with headaches a decade later.
The public needs to know that traumatic brain injury is a serious injury.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Frank Larkin, a retired Senate Sergeant at Arms, Navy SEAL, and Secret Service agent, wrote to Trump about the suicide of his son, Ryan, also a former Navy SEAL, after the president's comments.
It was a hit to the gut.
Larkin, writing Trump's words, were an undeserved punch felt by every person suffering from a TBI, their shattered families, and supporting communities.
Ryan had always said, something's wrong with my head, but nobody believes me.
On April 23, 2017, Ryan Larkin took his own life. His parents had watched their son deteriorate after years of his brain being subjected to military blasts. They donated his brain to a military medical study on the relationship of TBI and blast waves.
3 months later, they called us in and said, your son had an undiagnosed severe level of microscopic brain injury directly related to blast exposure.
That's a very, very unfortunate situation, obviously. Doc?
Yes, yeah, this is an ongoing problem, and the recognition of traumatic brain injury is becoming more and more apparent. We used to call it shell shock in the past and, you know, give it various names over time, but it's even now we're getting to the point where the body armor, central body armor, is able to protect you to the point where you can be even closer to these blast exposures, and you can still survive them. But the shock wave that's introduced to the brain, because the brain's like a jelly inside of a very hard, rock-hard skull, and as the brain shifts and moves around, it can become damaged. And there are special tests that can be done And we need to make sure that every veteran who comes forward with this complaint is adequately, professionally, and but done by someone who has competency in order to do the conduct these studies. And so I'm just I'm grateful for them coming forward, and I want to say condolences to the family for the loss of their son.
Sure.
And this goes on all the time.
Mm-hmm. This is a horrific situation, without a doubt. If anybody has a call in, you know, we always want to hear from you. 312-374-8130. There are all kind of things that are going on now, and we just have to see what's going on. There's a CNN audio, U.S. and Taliban signed an agreement. Ernesto was going to take care of that, but this was a handout military, so we're not going to... Okay, good. Doc, go ahead.
Okay, yes. Yeah. You know, we had two topics we were talking about earlier, but it was a, you know, there is a CNN report, and it's from a top U.S. General, say that military is preparing for all coronavirus scenarios, including potential pandemic. Mm-hmm. And they actually had, this was a source for an article, but it was, you know, grounded, no bowling, dining out, or handshakes for U.S. troops in South Korea after first soldier infected with coronavirus. And one of the things is that the American commanders in South Korea have imposed health protection condition Charlie for 28,500 U.S. troops and their families, which places restrictions on activities and mm-hmm. interpersonal contact after an American soldier stationed was found to tested positive for the COVID-19 virus. Now, COVID is a contraction of a word. It's actually coronavirus disease mm-hmm. found in the year 2019. And the actual organism that causes this is called SARS-CoV-2. So it's the severe acute respiratory syndrome virus.
Wow.
And so yeah. This actually happened in an area where the soldier was based, and that was in Camp Carroll in a town near Daegu, where the latest outbreak is centered. So he actually is under self-quarantine now, and they are doing contact tracing to find out who he actually came in contact with and what the spread of this virus would be. But the officials there in Korea actually noted that there were 216 of the 284 cases actually came from that town. So the USKF is implementing all appropriate control measures to help control the spread of the virus. But the level of of urgency is actually still level high because of the potential for this to actually spread to the troops.
Yeah.
So there are several things that people can do. We know that the troops usually get vaccinated before they go overseas.
Right.
You know, getting the, and I've, even here in our own country, mm-hmm. we should be, you know, making sure that people get their influenza vaccine, have enough medications on hand. People who have chronic diseases like diabetes, COPD, should be making sure they go back and get their medical conditions evaluated early, and make sure that they have adequate medications mm-hmm. on hand. Wash mm-hmm. their hands. Don't touch your face. The N95 mask is nothing. It doesn't
yeah.
work.
Sure.
Doc, how does this differ for a regular flu? Like, what's the difference between, like, say, the COVID-19 mm-hmm. versus a bad flu?
Okay, the COVID-19, right now we don't really know all the how bad it can get. The COVID-19 virus actually... initially, they said it was a death rate of about 2.6%, which means almost 3 people out of 100 people who got it would die.
Yeah, yeah.
But then that started to fall down because we didn't know the denominator. And I'll give you an example. If you were at a intersection and you had 8 car accidents there, right, you would think that's terrible. Why did you have mm-hmm. 8 car accidents? But we don't know what the time frame is for those mm-hmm. 8 car accidents. We don't know if about 100 cars went through, which would make it terrible, 8 out of 100, or if 10 million cars went through that same intersection, 8 out of 10 million. So as they find it, they're finding that the actual risk for death is actually much lower than what they thought initially.
This is something I think is very interesting, too. Honor Flight, mm-hmm. Illinois, recognizing women veterans. NBC News has an audio.
Taliban is next. I want to show you what just happened moments ago, this historic moment in Doha, Qatar. Representatives of the United States and the Taliban signing this agreement aimed at bringing peace to Afghanistan.
So a part of this plan, American forces in Afghanistan would be reduced, but also pave the way for peace talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government. More than 2,400 Americans have died over 18 years of fighting in Afghanistan. It is the longest fought conflict in American history. And there was a moment here at the end where just after the signing, a handshake between a representative of the United States and one of the leaders of the Taliban.
Thank God the war is over.
Yeah.
This is crazy. It's been the longest war in U.S. history. And then now we're basically now, you know, trying to, you know, see what we can do to try to keep the peace. I mean, so we're still going to keep about, I think it was 8,000 troops going to be still stationed there. We're taking about 4,000 off the table. So, I mean, that's a step in the right direction. But hopefully we don't get into these long, drawn-out conflicts with no resolution in sight. I mean, thank God this didn't turn out as bad as Vietnam. But we got to get away from these long, drawn-out conflicts with they have no real clear, definite mission that's involved with trying to resolve the actual conflict.
Yeah, but the thing that really gets me about that, that I'm really concerned about, is that it seems as though this was a move to have political exigency and expediency during an election time frame. So whether this is actually something that we can count on and count on with an enemy, you know, with an enemy that we've been working with, whether that actually is something that we can count on as a nation going forward, because political cycles move and people go from through cycles of holding office. But is this something that this country can actually depend on in the future and take our forces out of harm's way?
Mm-hmm. So we shall see on that.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. We certainly want to talk about, as I mentioned earlier, the honor flight, NBC News.
A first-of-its-kind mission to highlight the contributions of women in the military. This morning, an all-female flight of veterans is leaving for Washington, D.C. to visit the war memorials there built in their honor. NBC 5's Kai Martin is live with more for us. Kai?
Marion, the ceremony to officially announce that Operation Her Story, a special trip to D.C. for 100 women's veterans, is a go, is still taking place right behind me here at the Pritzker Military Library. So we stepped outside to bring you more on this story. This announcement ceremony is complete with a color guard from Naval Station Great Lakes, the women saluting. It was solemn, yet there's excitement here, too. While Honor Flight Illinois for men is very well known, there's never been a trip just for women's veterans here in the state. Operation Her Story will take off in October, and it's far from full at this point. One reason organizers say is that women who served in support positions often minimize their role. Most women 80 years ago had few options when joining up, but these women were caring for the injured. They were issuing manifests, doing VA paperwork. The flight is about validating their military service.
We are looking for women who served from 1940 to 1975 during three conflicts. One was the World War II, another Korean War, and Vietnam. When they left the military, they would go home and they would become a wife or student, or they would fit into society as a regular person. They didn't go to the American Legion Halls of VFW. It just was a no-no.
Amazing. Rochelle?
Yes. Operation Her Story.
Yeah.
Okay, when you think about that, you know, you put yourself in the position of the woman who has served, and she has a story. We all have a story.
Oh, sure.
You know what I'm saying? And I'm very happy and proud to be on that committee. I'm actually co-chair of the outreach. And it was an amazing event, you know, to finally announce it, even though it's gone other places. I've seen it in the news already, but, you know, it was just that major time that all of us came together to actually be seen together, just kind of a glimpse of what it's going to look like the day of the event. And when you think about Operation Her Story, I mean, when you, the women who are going, starting with World War II, Korea, mm-hmm, Vietnam, you know, and then there's going to be some support women going also, and those are the younger veterans that are in Iraq, Afghanistan, who are volunteering also, along with a lot of medical team, and, you know, it is just an amazing outreach for all of us to be able to be in one place, and I am really excited about it, and plus I'm on that flight too, so.
Oh, that's great. Congratulations.
That's my era. Yeah, thank you so much, and they're doing a wonderful job in, you know, tracking it. My whole thing was about making sure that African-American women were not left out of this part of, you know, this trip, because it is so important. Looking back at the males going to Washington, D.C. on the honor flight, the last one, one of our members, when she's a Vietnam veteran, there were three women on that flight. Seven African Americans total, and the 119 that were actually of other cultures, mostly one culture.
You know, it's nice to know, too, that they are recognizing people now other than Rosie the Riveter.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's part of her story.
Oh, sure,
you know what
is.
I'm saying? So
certainly.
That's part of her story. It means a lot. Every woman has a story, like I said, you know, and then we can, like, look at the New York Times, and you're talking about the first woman, you know, who is going to be in the Green Beret. You know, she's going to be a Green Beret in the force, the special forces, ops.
Yeah.
You know, this is amazing all by itself. So those continue stories, just amazing women, you know, and this is a young woman too, enlisted. She's enlisted, you know, and when you look at that and you think about, she had to be mentally and physically strong in order to get through that potential to be
special
a part of it, you know. So you have to know how strong she is, you know, to get past, because you know, with more men on there, because women are not in the special ops and they're not, you know, in that area. So, you know, she really had to prove herself. She proved herself. And, just looking at weapons, intelligence. And now, you know, medical engineering, she had to pass all that stuff, and navigation.
We have all these good news things, thank goodness. I love it, as you well
absolutely.
Know.
Absolutely.
But there's a whistleblower that claims that claims leaders of VA sought damaging information on women,
absolutely,
alleging sexual assault.
When you look at that, that's another story. It's another story that a woman has to tell. It's the story of them against us. That's what it looks like a lot of times. And it's, why would she have to make that up, you know? And when you think about Me Too and how many were denied, you know, oh, that didn't happen. She doesn't have to do that. She's already had notoriety being in the Veterans Affairs, you know, component in which she is, you know, part of legislation. She helps create legislation. She's monitoring it, you know. So it's no reason for them not to believe that that happened to her. I think she had better things to do than just say, hey, that man did something to me, you know. And that's the story that we all have to go through, though. And it has to be told over and over again. If she has to go and file a claim for it, if something happens in the military, it didn't happen. You have to prove that it happened. How can I prove that it happened when you don't have cameras there? You don't have a witness. You know what I'm saying? So it's your word against their word. And it's a horrible thing to have to do when you spend that much time in the military. She's a lieutenant. She was, you know, and then they're trying to find things that were in her record and things like that. What is all of that got to do with it? It reminds me of when veterans, females for sure, go to the hospital and they get agitated with the treatment that they get when they have to tell that story again, or when they go in for treatment and now they look in your records to see if you are mentally stable in there, and now they want to treat you a certain way. That means security can be called. Well, I shouldn't call them security. That's true. The federal police is called to stand by to monitor the situation. You know, it's not necessary. A lot of times it is just not necessary. So when you look at those stories over and over again, it's damaging to every woman. And if you know if it happens one place or to one woman, it's happening across the world.
Thank you so much. Sean, you're our person with money. The Military Times had a handout. Pentagon budget calls for civilizing military hospital. What about that, Sean?
Yeah, they're trying to basically
save money by trying to force or have more veterans use outside facilities instead of using things inside the VA. So this is basically a trend that's been going on for the last maybe 20, 30 years or so, but particularly more so in the last 10 to 15 years. You're starting to see the VA privatized in such a way that they'll give the veterans options to go and use VA non-VA facilities. But the problem is with that is the pushback is that does a civilian doctor have the same type of eyes and ears to basically pick up on some of the disabilities and some of the injuries that a veteran has? Because when you look at the situation, veterans are used to being around other veterans. So the idea of this saying, okay, we're going to start to scale back some of these two facilities and actually let them go to civilian hospitals. Now, if you want to do that for a choice and you feel more comfortable, by all means do that.
Sure.
One thing I thought that was interesting, Cliff, is that the VA actually had a rating system. It was a star system on the website. 1 to 5 stars basically told you if that hospital was a good VA hospital or a bad VA facility, okay? 1 star was bad, 5 stars was great. A lot of the VA facilities were falling short, 3 stars or less. Okay, that was probably the majority, if not at least a third, which is still deplorable, of those facilities getting from 3 stars to 1 star. Starting January of this year, the VA system, under Shulkin's leadership, decided to not have that type of rating system on the website. They went to a system that was more like the regular hospital system. So instead of looking at, is this facility good or bad? Is it highly rated or not highly rated? It's how long do you wait for a doctor? How long do you have to get treated for an illness? Were you happy with your treatment, things like that? More subjective things that don't give you a real concrete answer as to what the real quality of care is. To make it look like other hospitals. So the VA system can kind of mask itself, mask the quality. Now for argument's sake, you can say that it does kind of level the playing field in some ways because now you have an apples to apples comparison between what a VA facility can do versus what a civilian hospital can do. But the problem with that also is that you don't really have a real gauge as to what type of care you're getting. I think back to my father's situation. He was in the Air Force. He went to the VA hospital in D.C. Okay, the VA hospital in D.C. wanted to amputate his leg. Now, that's pretty severe and tragic on its own. He went to my sister, who was a hospital administrator, took him to a regular hospital across the street, and they actually said, you have gout, you just need some medication. He got medication, and all of a sudden, he was perfectly fine. Okay, so went to from the risk of losing his leg to just having some medication and being perfectly fine, living 20 more years and not having any issues at all. Okay, so yeah, some of the VA hospitals do suck.
Can I say this real quick? It's fine to have an evaluation of the facility, but what about rating the physician?
Yeah, I agree with that.
That's something that does not happen, and no one knows or has information on really how to go about that. I don't know. Maybe Dr. Arnold knows. Can you report the physician in the VA hospital or not? Because that's important.
Yeah. Well, you can, but the thing is that we have to break the collective consciousness of the veteran is trying to be a fake. The veteran is coming back with a condition that is not grounded in truth. And when veterans go and you are examined by someone who is seeing you, they should be seeing you as a patient that needs to have an adequate evaluation and testing that arrives at a diagnosis if one exists. But there seems to be a pushback by the government to recognize people's conditions. Mm-hmm. And I've known veterans who, have waited 10 years to get a condition recognized. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, yeah, you did have that. And so I think that's really where I have the problem with the VA system. The actual care, if they're doing an upper endoscopy, they're doing a colonoscopy, those kinds of things, they're pretty good. I mean, they do have adequate. But my thing is really when it comes to evaluating service members for service-connected conditions that I have a problem.
In we particular, are so pleased. Invisible wounds.
Yes.
In particular.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
We are, of course, pleased to have these great folks with us, and we'll continue more. That was Colonel Dr. David Arnold, you just heard. And, of course, that very proud lady is Rochelle Crump, and the gentleman who tells us where the money's going and where it is and so forth. We're always pleased to have him, Sharon Claiborne, and the attorney Ernesto Borges was supposed to be with us today, but his wife was sick, so we wanted to make sure.
Yes.
We hope she's well, okay? Mm-hmm. And we'll be back with more in just a moment.